It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the FBI announced a nationwide crackdown on child sex trafficking. We'll talk to a human trafficking expert about the effort known as Operation Cross Country and what happens next to the rescued victims of child sex trafficking.
As college tuitions continue to climb nationally, President Obama is proposing a post-secondary institution rating system, which would rate colleges on things like tuition, how much money students make after graduation, and the future debt load of graduates. He'd like the system to be in place by the academic year of 2015.
The president hopes to reward colleges that get good ratings by sending more federal financial aid their way. But some college leaders worry about using metrics to judge their overall value, and the plan could face opposition from those in Congress who fear too much government control over higher education.
Nick Hillman joins us now. He's an assistant professor in educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. He joins us in studio. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with those basics. What kinds of things would colleges get rated on under the plan as we know it?
Well, that's the million-dollar question because there's actually no plan yet, at least no details to the plan yet. Right now and over the next year or so, a group of experts are trying to come together with some recommendations for what ought to be measured and what ought to be included in this rating system. The details aren't finalized yet, so the jury is out still.
And, you know, some statistics right now, college tuition 3 times as expensive today as it was 30 years ago. That's adjusting for inflation. As you see it, is this a good way for the president to try to hold colleges' feet to the fire and hold them accountable?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's the question that policy advocates and policymakers have been asking for years and not really having an answer to. There's a sense that something has to be done. We've got to reverse these financial trends where college is getting more and more expensive for families. But how exactly we do that is really uncertain. And so to your previous question about these rating systems and about what's measured in these rating systems, that's why it's so important to get it right and to be able to measure something that matters. For example, if the rating system says, well, graduation rates are going to be one of the things that we measure here, a place like Madison might do really well under those metrics. However, if they were to measure something like the percentage of students who are low income, Madison wouldn't do very well on that metric. So finding out the right measure, the right data to be monitoring and judging colleges on is important, but also realizing that one size fits all just might not work for all campuses across the country. It's going to be tough to do.
Yeah, and this plan is still pretty embryonic, but it's ruffled quite a few feathers already. There was a New York Times piece about college presidents responding quite concerned about what this could say about their college campuses. And then when you bundle this in with the fact that President Obama would like to direct financial aid to colleges based on these metrics, and it gets even more complicated, why do you think it's been so controversial so far?
Well, there are two parts of the controversy, I think. The first one is the primary purpose of the rating system. What is the primary purpose? That question hasn't really been answered in a really consistent way so far. And so that's part of the controversy. Some advocates say, well, we want this rating system to help students make better choices about where they go to college. If they just made better choices, maybe we wouldn't be in this big mess that we are in right now. And so by that standard, it's seen as sort of a consumer advocacy-oriented, you know, mechanism. On the other hand, though, you've got folks who say, well, this rating system is really important to hold institutions accountable for broad policy goals. So if our policy goal, if the federal government's policy goal is to expand opportunities for low-income students, for example, then they would want to be sure to measure, hold the feet to the fire, right, with that measurement. So there's not really consensus about whether this is supposed to be designed to help students make choices or whether it's supposed to be designed to help institutions be more accountable to the public. That really hasn't been clear, and it's going to be hard to do both with one system.
Well, let's take a look at the consumer advocacy angle. A White House spokesperson sort of compared it to a blender, saying, well, you know, there are ratings on blenders and I can look and I can choose based on these ratings. Why shouldn't this work the same way? Why shouldn't the market shake down the way colleges are approached by consumers? Because in a sense, families and students, they're consumers. What's wrong with that argument? Is there anything?
There is a lot wrong with that argument. And the people who are advocating for these policy changes, I think aren't as willing to engage in those conversations. That's a little bit too abstract, I think, to really wrestle with. We want nice, clean solutions to problems and wash our hands and be done and move on. But this is really messy. The marketplace for educational opportunities is one that has winners and losers, just like any market does. And so framing education as a consumer product, as a consumption activity, not only privatizes and individualizes the experience, but also sets us up for this kind of competition where second and third chances aren't necessarily what we value and what we prioritize. And so the market logic, the market rationale is a tough one to sort of force into this discussion, but it's a convenient one because we can say, well, we measure things and we can put a rating on it. And just like we rate a blender, we can also rate a college. And it's overly simplified and promises more than what can actually probably deliver.
You know, for some students, there is a mystique around the very idea of colleges. Some colleges have a lot of that aura. You know, look at the Ivy Leagues like Princeton and Harvard and Yale. They seem like places if you get in, you might not be thinking so much about the price tag. You're just thinking, hey, I got into one of these big name universities. I'm going to worry about the price tag later. But maybe this could have the effect of sort of stripping some of that aura away and forcing students to look at sort of the brass tacks of it. Is that something that could happen? And would that be a positive?
In theory, it could. The evidence isn't there to say that it does or will. And so sometimes we look to the health industry, not often for examples, but in this case, it might actually apply, where there were some ratings for cardiac surgeons, for example, in the early 90s in New York, where they had some incentives to actually underserve the sickest patients. And so because this performance standards were, or the performance incentives were designed in a way to really just serve those who have the best potential of outcomes. So a place like an Ivy League school like Harvard or Yale, or a place that's striving to be more prestigious, might actually have an incentive to turn students away. And so then those are the colleges that have the greatest amount of resources and that can help students pay for college and keep prices low through their endowments, for example. But it's your regional public schools, it's your community colleges, it's other colleges that enroll far more students that don't have those kind of resources, and the students don't necessarily have the luxury of shopping around and choosing which college is right for them. They want one that's convenient, that's close by, where they can keep working their full-time jobs, for example.
Right. And so is your argument there that, you know, you live somewhere that has a local college, you can afford it, and it's going to admit you. It might not get great ratings, so maybe you shouldn't be scared away from it.
That's kind of, yeah, I mean, that's kind of a purpose of this rating system, I think. I would hope that would be the case. But the challenge, though, is getting those measurements right and getting the metrics right so that a college like that doesn't get a poor rating and, as a result, doesn't get its federal aid stripped out from under it. And so that's going to be the real challenge, is who is this? What kind of college is this designed for? What kind of college student or prospective student is this designed to really serve? And those questions really haven't been answered, and it's going to be answered soon based on what they decide to measure in the rating system.
Well, we presume that it's designed to measure overall quality, and that's a difficult concept. Is it possible to come up with a metric that evaluates the quality of an education?
No, I don't think it is. And the evidence on student engagement and the influence of institutions, for example, on student learning is pretty sparse. I mean, it's not like it's a really cut and dry answer that we can measure quality in a really sophisticated or consistent way. In fact, the definition of quality is so subjective that each individual person has a different answer on what quality means to them, and especially in experience goods and service industries like education and health, for example. So you could have, you go to the doctor and you have really good bedside manner. The doctor has really good bedside manner. You might think that that's a good quality, depending on your preferences of what you like to have for that experience. Somebody else might prefer a doctor who doesn't stick them poorly with the needle. So there's a lot of different ways we can measure quality and a lot of subjective ways to measure quality. And so a rating system, to get it right, would have to be able to measure every single possible option there, and it's just impossible to do. And so on those merits, no, you can't measure quality.
We're joined now by Nick Hillman, Assistant Professor in Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. We're talking about President Obama's proposal for a national college rating system, which he'd like to be in effect by the academic year of 2015. The proposal comes as tuitions soar and graduates are having trouble in the job market.
And we'd like to hear from you. Would you make use of a college rating system like this, maybe for yourself, maybe for your kid? Would this help hold colleges accountable or maybe stigmatize colleges unfairly? And if you are a high school counselor looking at students applying for college, or if you work at a college or university, what do you make of this idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about President Obama's proposal for a national college rating system. The president has said he'd like to see the system up and running by the academic year of 2015. The proposal comes as we see students graduating with large debt loads and entering shaky job markets. We're joined now by Nick Hillman, Assistant Professor in Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison.
And we'd like to hear from you. Would you like to see a system like this in place, or would you have liked to see it in place before you went to college? What would you want to see rated in a system like this? What would you want to see it evaluate? What would be useful to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. And how do you measure the value of a college education? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Nick, to follow up on the question of what would you like to see rated, one of the things that seems to be on a lot of people's minds is the amount of debt that their students or they are going to accumulate if they get that college degree. And that seems like a good starting point.
Absolutely. And the question that you asked before about can you measure quality kind of gets to this too. Yes, you can measure these things. You can measure debt burden. You can measure students, preferences on certain surveys and things like that. It's possible to measure all these items, but to measure it in a way that's meaningful to everybody in the same way is very different. So, for example, with student loan debt, that's a pretty, standard measurement. I mean, people know what a dollar is worth and what it means to be $1,000 or $10,000 in debt. They have a sense of what we have a sense of what that means to our pocketbooks. And so that ought to be included in the measure. In the rating system in some way. Some sort of affordability measurement is core to helping students understand the financial implications of their decision to enroll in school. But at the same time, there's no guarantee that you will graduate with $10,000 in debt or any certain dollar value of debt, because you don't actually accumulate that debt until well after you've enrolled. And so that's one of the big challenges of trying to provide information that says, okay, you might graduate with this amount of debt, but there's really no guarantee.
And we're going to go to our phones now, and you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about having a national college rating system, and what would you like to see rated? We're going to go first to Dan in Menominee. Hi, Dan.
Hi. So I just wanted to make a comment about it. I went to the University of Minnesota up in Crookston, Minnesota, and I went to school for environmental science, basically, it's natural resources, and graduated in 3 years, and I did leave with about $20,000 in student debt. The thing that I did like about the University of Minnesota Crookston and the whole University of Minnesota system is that they have a 13-credit expense cap. So if you take 13 credits or anything lower than that, you pay the number of credits you take. But if you take 14, 18, 21 credits, you still only pay for the 13 credits.
Okay,
so it really... What?
Sure, go ahead, Dan.
So it just encourages the students to take more credits and get out of college sooner.
All right, great point. Thank you, Dan. So someone, University of Minnesota, Minnesota approaching it from a different perspective. What about approaches like that?
Yeah. This is the neat thing about the way that our public universities are organized and governed is they have autonomy to do what's best for students and to organize their curriculum and their programs in ways that are the most responsive to what their educational goals are. And so the federal rating system wouldn't go so far, at least it shouldn't go so far, as to say, you know, every school needs to adopt the example that Dan just gave. So you don't see, you're not going to see that level of detail of sort of influence from the federal rating system. But the rating system might ask things about how long does it take for a student to graduate on average. Might be helpful information for somebody who's trying to search out the right college for them. They can say, hey, well, how long did it take my classmates to finish their degrees? Whether or not that's going to influence how they behave is a whole different issue, but it's been proposed.
Another interesting critique that has come up of this whole plan is that it could disproportionately affect liberal arts programs, because one proposed metric would be how much do graduates earn when they get out. And so if you look at, you know, I don't know, an English major to pick on them, they might not be earning, you know, the same thing a business major is making.
Right. And employers, from my understanding of the research on this, the employers are more interested in an employee who can get along with people and who can be a positive person in the work environment. And so the liberal arts, I can think of really no better place for a student or a person to grow in those ways. And so, yeah, they might not make the kind of money that somebody who's studying something else, like business, for example, will do, but they might have other skills and other dispositions that employees are looking for. And so that's a tricky one, too. So if you only think that money is the only thing that matters in the labor market and not these quality of life indicators or other types of factors that matter in employability and in your work experience, then we're preferencing one despite the promise and potential of others that are also important.
And let's go back to the phone lines. Now, Pam is with us in New Holstein. Hi, Pam.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
My comment is I've helped my children, myself included. I had loans when I went to school, and then when I decided to get my master's, I took advantage of a employer contribution to my education. But I've helped my kids to kind of pick where they wanted to go, looking at job placement after graduation, where jobs are in the field that they're looking at, how much will it cost to get that education at that facility, because what we found out is that a lot of times, like my one daughter wants to go into accounting, that she could get the same job with an associate degree as she could a bachelor's degree. So she can just go to technical college for that instead of paying for a bachelor's degree.
Okay, so Pam's talking about different ways to approach those degrees, getting creative with solutions, and maybe ratings like this would help if you're looking from that perspective. What do you think?
It could, but that kind of gets at the point of what all are you going to include in this rating system? All the questions, all the potential questions that a family or a student are going to want answers to are so numerous that a rating system isn't going to be able to answer everybody's questions in the kind of way that they might like. And so will the rating system take the accounting program at a local community college and rate that program and rate it in comparison to the local bachelor's accounting program? I don't think so, but that's kind of the level of detail that families like the lady who just called in would like to have. And so it gets back to the point of, you know, what we measure is going to matter here, and it's going to not capture things completely. And so it kind of mutes the impact that it might have, that a rating system might have on any sort of behavioral decisions that people make. A lot of times people are making their educational choices, if they have choices at all, according to intrinsic preferences and futures that are that are no way to be known. And so so sometimes it's not even the questions about labor market returns. It's more questions about just how well do I fit at this institution.
Right. At one point, Nick, that you make, you've written about that, is that you think it's impossible to know the outcome of an education until after it's over. You want to speak to that and why you think that might get in the way of the efficacy of a rating system?
Sure, sure. That's a great question. The ratings proponents, like the undersecretary who is leading this effort at the federal level, has compared a rating system to a blender. She says it's just as easy as measuring and rating a blender, and so we should be able to apply that same type of logic to education. But when I buy a blender, I had no involvement in the production of that blender. It was made in China, and I just bought it off the shelf for $10. And I could have bought the one next to it for $15, but I chose this one for whatever reason. But I had no part in making that blender. I strictly consumed it. And I had a warranty on it, by the way. And so when it comes to my education or my healthcare or anything where I'm the input, but I'm also the product of some sort of function, then it just screws up the way that we think about all of this stuff. So for education, for example, I'm not just a passive learner that's just sort of downloading information that I can retain in my head. I'm part of a learning experience. And the way that I engage with my learning experience is the way that I'm going to leave that institution. And so if the college is doing what's right, they should be able to be transformative in people's lives. And so by virtue of that, it's going to be impossible to, use a rating system in terms of consumer reports and how we rate blenders. It's we got to think of it in a new way of how we think colleges ought to change people's well-being.
Nick, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Nick Hillman, an assistant professor in educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we find out how to transition to a more eco-friendly lifestyle without incurring stress, and maybe we can save some pennies in the process.
Yesterday, the FBI announced the rescue of 168 child sex trafficking victims and arrested 281 pimps in cities across the country. 12 of those arrested were in Milwaukee. 6 children were rescued in Wisconsin.
The arrests were part of the annual enforcement push known as Operation Cross Country. This is the 8th such week-long operation. Operation Cross Country is part of the FBI's Innocents Lost National Initiative. It was established in 2003 in coordination with the Department of Justice and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to address the problem of child prostitution.
Here to talk about child sex trafficking in the United States is Bridget Carr. She's the director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Bridget, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with an overview of Operation Cross Country. How does the FBI go about carrying on such a big coordinated effort like this one?
Well, so much of child sex trafficking and really human sex trafficking overall takes place on the internet. And so law enforcement can monitor a lot of what's happening. And so they do these operations every year or so and are able to take down a number of pimping organizations.
And the FBI announced that they arrested 281 pimps as part of this operation, rescued around 170 victims. How big a dent do numbers like those make in the overall effort to put sex traffickers out of business?
Well, sadly, we don't really know the prevalence of human trafficking or sex trafficking in America today. We don't keep track of the numbers very well. And the numbers you just cited give us an example of that. Of the almost 300 pimps that they arrested, one of the questions I always have is how many of those are women who are 18, 19, 20, who if this operation had happened a month or a year ago would have been in the victim category. It's a troubling reality of anti-trafficking work in America today that, you know, if you get caught before you turn some magic number, you may be considered a victim. But if you're 18 or above, you're probably going to be considered a criminal.
You said we don't really know how big a problem child sex trafficking is in this country, but we can triangulate a little bit, I'm guessing, based on some of the figures we do know. Can you give us a sense about how widespread it is?
We really can't, because I can tell you right now that a number of those victims, 16 and 17-year-olds who were found in the operation this week, if they were in Michigan, for example, and had been encountered by a state or local law enforcement in Michigan at 16 or 17, would have been charged as prostitutes under our state law. And each state differs in what age they view someone a prostitute or potentially a victim of child sex trafficking. So you can't really figure out the data points from that, because you essentially have 50 different state systems regulating prostitution, keeping track of data in different ways. It wasn't until a couple of years ago, even, that the Uniform Crime Reporting System for the FBI included trafficking as its own category.
Well, what about safe harbor laws? Do those come into play?
So safe harbor laws mean different things to different constituencies. For someone like me, I hope that means immunity, that we treat victims of sex trafficking, specifically child victims, as victims of sexual abuse. However, the way it's interpreted by states can be very different. There are states that say they have safe harbor, and it just means that they have an affirmative defense for kids. There are states that say they have safe harbor, and it means that they have a presumption of victimization as long as you comply with court-ordered services. I hope that we get to a point in the U.S. where safe harbor means that you're treated as a victim of sexual abuse if you are a child sex trafficking victim.
Do you think there needs to be one uniform national standard for what safe harbor means?
That would be nice, but in our federalist system, we can't regulate it in that way. The federal government can, you know, provide some incentives, but it's really going to require the type of paradigm shift that we saw with domestic violence. And state by state, we're going to have a much deeper understanding of what sex trafficking is. And the most important understanding is that we really need to focus our attention on the perpetrators and the buyers, on their thoughts, actions, and decisions, and not on the victims. Right now, the spotlight is on, well, did she make bad choices? Did she return to her pimp too many times? And, you know, if we would be having those conversations about people who are raped without money or about victims of domestic violence, that would be frowned upon. But in the sex trafficking world, that is accepted right now.
Now, we spoke to Cindy McCain, wife of Senator John McCain, not long ago this year. It's one of her personal missions to fight sex trafficking. And she talked about one of the important things being to educate people about what trafficking looks like, in particular airlines she was focusing on. But what do we know about what it looks like if people want to take part and try to help?
Well, right now in America, we tend to think that it looks very foreign and very exotic, that it looks like the movie Taken. It's much more mundane than that. It's often about, you know, it's about traffickers targeting vulnerable people. And if those vulnerable people for child sex trafficking victims are people who may be poor, they may come from broken homes, and they're looking for what pimps often offer them, which is love, acceptance. And so if we keep looking for this very foreign, you know, foreign individuals brought in and kept chained to a radiator, we're going to miss most of the sex trafficking that's happening around us.
And when these kids are rescued, as in the operation with the FBI, what kind of shape do they generally come in as psychologically speaking?
Well, it's really hard. I mean, for many victims of child sex trafficking, they are angry about being rescued. They want to return to their pimp. They may believe that they are in love with that person. And so when we have a narrative in the United States that these victims should be grateful and should act accordingly, I often say we have sort of the Lifetime movie version of victims as the narrative. And then when victims don't behave that way, we often then think, well, then they're not victims. And we have to stop putting expectations on victims. Victims are victims because of what happened to them, not because of how they behave.
And what happens when the kids have been rescued? What sorts of services are available to them to help them reacclimate with families, maybe, in society again?
For U.S. citizen victims, it's really a state-by-state determination about what benefits are available. So, for example, in Michigan, child victims of sex trafficking cannot be put in the child protection system as victims of sexual abuse. If they get into that system at all, it's often through a juvenile delinquency route, and that is in and of itself problematic. In Illinois, they can go in as victims of sexual abuse. So, again, there are probably 50 varieties of the types of services available for these victims.
So there's lots of different approaches to treatment and the way sex trafficking victims are seen in the eyes of the state. But can you give us an example of a state that you think is doing good things when it comes to handling child sex trafficking victims?
I think Illinois is doing some really wonderful things. They have categorized child sex trafficking victims as victims of sexual abuse. They are trying to put in place the right support systems, and they have some universities who are working on trying to study really evidence-based approaches to serving these victims. The real dilemma is that while we're happy to talk about human trafficking nationwide, no one is doing the really hard work of figuring out evidence-based ways of treating the types of trauma these individuals have experienced.
So what would you like to see people doing in terms of the hard work you're talking about?
you know, I would like to see people trying new approaches, being willing to fail, but most importantly, being willing to evaluate it. Too often we see in the human trafficking space people giving out really good sound bites that aren't backed up. Sometimes this work is quite mundane and not very sexy, and so we need to take some quiet time and really figure out what works and, more importantly, what doesn't work, so that when we are doing these types of operations that have just happened, that when the victims come out, we have something to offer them that can actually help them.
What would you like listeners to know about child sex trafficking that they may not?
You know, I think the most important thing that I want listeners to know is that child sex trafficking victims only exist because there are buyers in your community. And that's the thing we never talk about. This operation doesn't happen if our husbands, dads, brothers, friends, and others weren't buying sex. And that's tough to hear and tough to think about, but that's the reality.
Bridget, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Bridget Carr, director of the Human Trafficking Clinic at the University of Michigan Law School. Eco-living may be on the rise, but making the transition to a greener lifestyle can create stress and guilt, making some people give up before they've tried.
It doesn't have to be that way, our next guest says. Having lived through some shame and fear of never feeling green enough, she's gathered some simple strategies to make the process doable and to save some money along the way.
Madeline Somerville is the author of All You Need Is Less, which she calls an eco-friendly guide to guilt-free green living. She blogs at sweetmadeline.ca. Madeline, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you decide to embark on this journey of doing more with less?
Well, it started about a decade ago. My husband and I moved to British Columbia, Canada, which is sort of known up here as the hippie province. And a few years later, we got a dog. And I remember bringing him home, and he was this chubby little adorable puppy. And he flopped on the floor and started licking our floor, our kitchen floor. And I realized that that was the same floor that I had mopped with this chemical cleaner a few hours earlier. And I started just looking at the products I was using in my home and on my body and realizing that I didn't know a whole lot about the ingredients that were in them or what the effects were. And so from there, I started to do what I think a lot of people do as their first step. And I started buying green cleaners and you know, eco-friendly shampoos and that kind of thing. And it got really expensive because those things tend to be, it seems like they're 2 to 3 times the price of their regular alternatives. And then it kind of got frustrating because I realized that some of the stuff that was being labeled as eco-friendly wasn't. And I had a moment where I was looking at the ingredients on this laundry detergent, and I decided to look them up, and I realized that they were things that were readily accessible to me and that I could actually make it myself. And that by doing that, I knew exactly what was going into it. I knew exactly where it was coming from. It was way less expensive, and I could adjust it if I needed to, if I wanted it to have less fragrance or a different fragrance or, you know, more soap or less soap. And that was kind of like the aha moment for me, was realizing that I could create these things in a really simple way and a less expensive way, and that I didn't have to go and buy them.
Let's set you along the road, and then you hit some other challenges along the way. Tell us how you convinced your husband to start composting.
Well, the town that we lived in was a very small town called Squamish, BC, and it had bears. Like, it was fairly, I mean, it was civilized, but bears would regularly stroll through your backyard. So backyard composting wasn't really something that many people did. And so our town had set up a compost center at the same place that you drop off your bottles. And I decided it was time that we started composting. I'm a vegetarian, so we had tons of fruit and veggie scraps, and they were just going in the garbage. And composting is one of the biggest ways that you can reduce the waste that's coming out of your house. So I decided that we were going to do this. And I made that executive decision. And I didn't want fruit flies in this compost bin, so I decided I would start storing them in my freezer. So I started hoarding fruit and vegetable scraps in our freezer, and wasn't maybe always the most prompt about taking them to the depot. And my husband, it was like this routine in my house where I would feel, you know, super good about myself and be patting myself on the back for composting. And meanwhile, I was just storing fruit and veggie scraps in our freezer until my husband would like throw them out in a fit of rage because he could never find anything because we had garbage in our freezer. And so that was sort of like this moment that I think a lot of people run into, where you may be super gung-ho about going green and doing all these eco-friendly things, and your partner or your coworkers or your roommate is just not into it for whatever reason. So we had to troubleshoot that a little bit. and tweaked the routine, which involved him sort of getting on board with it as long as I was more conscientious about taking stuff in a more prompt manner, so our freezer was actually being used for food rather than compost.
I can just imagine that. What's for dinner? Let's look in the freezer. Oh, my God. And it's just this, like, bag of glop.
Yeah, and it was just, I mean, I can't blame him, but there was definitely some conversations where it was like, why do you hate Mother Nature? Why aren't you helping me? So I think that's something that a lot of people run into. And it's not something I ever saw addressed in the eco-friendly books. Like, it just seemed like everyone had these perfect partners who were like, oh, you want to give up your fridge? Of course, let's go for it. And that was just not what I encountered. And I knew I wasn't the only one. I hope to God I wasn't the only one.
Let's talk about that, because there tends to be sometimes, you know, some guilt that comes along with these lifestyles. And sometimes people are doing it out of guilt, but it seems like a hassle and they feel like they're not doing enough of it, or their neighbor has 4 compost bins plus rain barrels. I mean, how do you just do what you can and be okay with that?
I think it comes from, first of all, just stopping the judging. And that's a huge thing, because I even get criticism anytime I post an article on any website. There's always comments going, you know, oh, but you're using this and that has been linked to the, and it's like, you can never be green enough, and there's always somebody judging you, and we judge ourselves really harshly too. So even me, like I obviously try and live a very green lifestyle, but I'm not a huge cook. And so I often am like beating myself up because I'm not cooking as much and I should be doing things from scratch. The key is to stop. And one of the biggest things that you can do to be eco-friendly is also one of the easiest, and it's just to stop consuming and to really reduce the amount that you're buying and just sort of question everything to the point where, do I really need this? What's going to happen to it when I'm done with it? Sort of slow things down to the point where you can actually look at your life and maybe put a pause button on this whole cycle of consume and throw out and consume and throw out. And once you sort of hit that pause button, just look around and see what changes you are excited about making. You know, someone might not be super excited to use a clothesline, which I really love, but they might be really excited to make their own food or start canning. And so that's a really good place to start, is some place that you're excited to take it on. And then just make really small, gradual changes. Like, I think in order for this to be sustainable, it needs to be small and it needs to be gradual. So rather than, you know, somebody reading my book and then tearing through their house, throwing everything out and buying all new, you know, everything else. Like, it just needs to be, you know, when your toothpaste runs out, maybe try the recipe for homemade toothpaste and see if you like it. And if you don't, that's totally fine. You can go back to regular toothpaste, and I list an organization that will recycle the tubes. Or, you know, maybe next time when you run out of window cleaner, you can try this recipe. Like, just do it really gradually and focus on what you are doing rather than sort of comparing yourself and beating yourself up about what you're not doing, because that's a really easy cycle to get into.
Well, I'd love to check out a couple of the recipes you mentioned. Let's, how about that toothpaste? How do we make our own?
Okay, so the toothpaste is one that I found personally, like, a little bit, it took a bit of an adjustment, because it's way less sweet than a lot of our toothpaste, which might sound funny, but it's a really basic mix of peppermint oil, baking soda, and water. And you basically just mix it together and you get a fine paste. And baking soda is a really great gentle abrasive. And when I first started using this, as I said, it was a little bit, like, it's a little bit saltier than normal toothpaste. And now I'm at the point where when I use regular toothpaste, it almost tastes like icing sugar or something. It tastes weird to me. But when I started using it, I started wondering if the baking soda was harming the teeth enamel, because it does seem like it's grittier than normal toothpaste. So I did some research, and it actually scores, dentists use this fancy thing called this relative dentin abrasiveness scale. And baking soda clocks in at a 7. It goes from 0 to 200, the scale. And baking soda clocks in at a 7, and then the nearest commercial toothpaste comes in at a 35. Huh. So even though you feel, because it's a manual abrasive rather than a chemical abrasive, you feel it more, but it's way more gentle on your teeth. There's no packaging associated with it aside from the baking soda box.
And it works? You're not getting cavities? Your teeth aren't falling out?
It took me a while to admit to my dentist that I was doing this, because I always, you know, sometimes you just don't want to get into the whole, like, I don't want to preach, and sometimes I just don't want to get into the whole shebang when I'm sitting there with my mouth propped open. But when I finally confessed to my dentist, he's like, I always get comments that my teeth are very strong, like, I don't have, you know, my teeth are nice, I think. And it gives you that kind of shiny, slippery, slick feeling you get from the dentist. Like, it feels amazing. And it's something that's a really easy thing for most people to try. Like, most people have baking soda and water in their house, and peppermint essential oil or peppermint extract is something you can easily find in the baking aisle.
Well,
so it's sort of a low risk thing to try.
Let's look at another one. You mentioned making your own shampoo and conditioner. Those seem like hard things to pull off. Toothpaste, maybe, but, you know, there's so many hair care products out there now that do so much. How does this work, and does it work on your hair?
This is the most bizarre thing I've ever, the most strange green thing I've ever tried, and the thing I get the most questions on. And it's also literally almost the easiest recipe in the whole book. To make your own shampoo, what you're basically doing is you're mixing a cup of warm water with a tablespoon of baking soda. So you mix that together until the baking soda is dissolved. Hop in the shower. When you've got wet hair, you pour this mixture over your head and really massage it into your scalp. It's not going to foam because it doesn't have sodium lauryl sulfate, which is one of the more dangerous chemicals that is in a lot of foaming products like toothpaste and shampoos. So it's not going to foam, but you're basically just going to concentrate on your scalp. If you've got oily hair, you want to concentrate along the hairline and along the crown of your head. Once you've sort of rubbed that all in, you just rinse it out. The conditioner is same thing, very simple. It's one cup of warm water with 1 to 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar mixed in. And apple cider vinegar has a strong smell, and this recipe isn't in the book, but somebody alerted it to me, and I've tried it, and it works, is that you can also substitute fresh lemon juice, which for people who object to the apple cider vinegar smell, lemon juice is great. So 1 cup of warm water, 1 to 2 tablespoons of either apple cider vinegar or lemon juice, and once your shampoo rinse is out of your hair, you put that in your hair, you let it sit for a few minutes, just like regular conditioner, rinse that out. It's the most amazing thing. It doesn't seem like it should work, because I, too, spent years spending ridiculous amounts on these salon shampoos and conditioners, but my hair was always fluffy and light and, like, tangle-free.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Madeline, thank you so much for joining us and sharing these recipes.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, and try them. They're fantastic.
We've been talking with Madeline Somerville. She's the author of All You Need Is Less.